the end of my lecture series today. And so in the last lecture, I'd like to tell you something about the properties of the Higgs boson. And at the end of the lecture, I'll talk a little about what we actually know experimentally about these properties. So let's begin with the theory of the Higgs boson. Actually, the elementary couplings of the Higgs boson and the Lagrangian are really remarkably easy to work out. There just isn't much to them. And the reason for that is that if we are interested in the tree-level couplings, we can just go to the unitarity gauge in the electroweak theory. So in the unitarity gauge, so in a general gauge, the Higgs doublet is represented like this, V plus H of X plus I pi 0. But then you remember that these things are the Goldstone bosons associated with electroweak symmetry breaking. And when you go to unitarity gauge, you can gauge away the Goldstone bosons. And then you're just left with this. And the picture that comes from this is very simple. V, which is the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field, which has a value, by the way, of 246 GeV, is the only scale in the standard model. Once we know that, that sets the scale of the quark masses, the vector boson masses, and the Higgs mass itself. To find the Higgs coupling, at least at momentum equals 0, we just differentiate with respect to V. And that's the whole story. And if you have a momentum-independent coupling, as most of the Higgs couplings are, then you just have the whole story for the coupling. So I can immediately write down that the Higgs coupling to any fermion is just minus I mf over V. The Higgs coupling to any boson, remember this depends on the mass squared, is mv squared over v times g mu nu. And even the Higgs coupling to itself is given by, I believe, minus I times 3 mh squared over v. So that's the whole theory of the tree-level coupling of the Higgs bosons. Please notice that essentially automatically in the standard model, this vertex is completely CP invariant and flavor conserving. And so now we just have to work out what, in more detail, the story is that follows from these fundamentals. Now, when people first thought about the Higgs boson, the story that followed from those Feynman rules was completely obvious. The Higgs boson couples according to mass in the way that I've written here, and therefore it couples most strongly to the heaviest particles of the standard model. And so therefore, obviously, the dominant Higgs decays were going to be to WW and ZZ, to TT bar. W and W and ZZ have a little advantage that we're going to discuss a little later. But these are obviously the modes in which you would like to look for the Higgs boson, find resonances, and identify this particle. Unfortunately, or fortunately, the Higgs boson mass, well, of course, we now know is about 125 GeV. And the thresholds for these processes are 160, 180, and 350. So all of these modes of Higgs decay are actually energetically forbidden. And so what that means is that the Higgs has to decay to whatever it can decay to without the availability of its most important channels. The Higgs couples to everything because at least, well, let me say this qualifier for the last time. In this lecture, I'm only going to talk about the theory of Higgs within the standard model. And when you go beyond the standard model, even when you just have two Higgs doublets, things become a lot more complicated. But within the standard model, it's very simple. The Higgs couples to everything proportional to mass. Anything that has mass has a Higgs boson coupling. And in principle, there should be a list of many things that the Higgs boson decays to. So given that these three are absent, we then have to look for the secondary modes with which the Higgs can decay, which then become the only ones available. So let's make a list of those. And then maybe I'll go through the theory of them somewhat systematically. So first of all, if the top quark is not available, the Higgs can decay to any lighter fermion. And those would be BB bar, tau plus tau minus, CC bar, maybe SS bar, mu plus mu minus, even electrons at some very low rate. Secondly, even though the Higgs cannot decay to on-shell W bosons because it's too light, it is able to decay to off-shell W bosons, which then decay further to quarks and leptons. And let's call those processes WW star and ZZ star. And they actually are relatively important modes of Higgs decay, which deserve our attention. Finally, it's going to turn out that these decays are already sufficiently suppressed, and they'll be suppressed by powers basically of the factor up there, the B quark mass divided by the Higgs vacuum expectation value. That's 2%, and you get to square it. So that's sufficient suppression that some loop processes are going to come in here. And so we should add to this list the Higgs decay to glu glu, to gamma gamma, and to gamma z. And actually, it turns out that the Higgs decays to more or less everything I've written on this blackboard occur at a level above a branching ratio of 10 to the minus 4. So the thing that, probably the most interesting thing that we've learned about the Higgs boson from the discovery and the fact that this particle exists at a mass of 125 GeV is that there's a tremendous richness of decays which potentially can be observed mostly at the SSC and eventually also at other at the LHC and eventually at other facilities. So actually, in the discovery seminar of the Higgs, Fabiola Giannotti said, "Thank you, nature, because this program of study is still available to us." So what I'd like to do in this lecture is basically go through these various categories of Higgs decay, tell you a little about the theory that gives rise to the value of the partial width into each of these modes, and then talk a little about the experimental status of that theory vis-a-vis the LHC experiments. We might as well start here. These are definitely the easiest ones. So the Higgs decay to fermions are given by this simple Feynman diagram. The matrix element reading from up there is I MF over V. U dagger of whatever is that fermion, it's just one U of the V of the antifermion. And that is actually pretty much the whole story. If I have a right-handed fermion by chirality conservation, or rather this is a chirality flip vertex, it gives rise to a right-handed antifermion here, and vice versa. Again, with ignoring the fermion mass, now that we've included one factor of it here, and using these helicity spinners, we can very easily work this out. This is MF over V. This guy's helicity spinner, so there's a 2E of the fermion, square root, and then it comes squared. There's a helicity spinner here, which is 1, 0. There's a helicity spinner here, which is 1, 0. And then very quickly, we'll get this value in here is actually the Higgs mass. So very quickly, we'll get a value of this amplitude, which is MF M Higgs divided by V times 1. And then there are two possible helicity states. This can be the F left or the F right. And so the partial width for Higgs to FF bar is then 1 over 2 mh, 1 over 8 pi for phase space, the square of this expression, if you allow me to substitute V as mw squared divided by 1/4 g squared, then we have an alpha weak in this expression, and you can rewrite it as alpha weak over 8. Oh, sorry, and there's a factor of 2. You can rewrite it as alpha weak over 8 times m Higgs times m fermion over m Higgs squared. And if the fermion has a mass, there's a phase space factor, and actually a factor also in the amplitude, which is 4 mf squared over mh squared to the 3/2. Okay, well, that's a pretty simple theory. It's about the simplest Feynman diagram computation you can possibly do, but it's already extremely effective. For example, for the leptons, tau and mu, we know what the masses are. If we know the mass of the Higgs, we can just plug into that formula directly, and you come out with Higgs to tau plus tau minus is 260 keV, and Higgs to mu plus mu minus is 9 keV. So it's going to turn out that this is a few percent branching ratio of the Higgs when we get done with everything on that table, and this will turn out to be at the 10 to the minus 4 level. And the electron, 2 orders of magnitude below. Now, for quarks, the situation is just a little more complicated, but not very much more. The problem with quarks is this computation applies. There's a color factor of 3, but then there are various QCD corrections that we need to account for. And it's not hard. You just have to keep your wits about you. So for quarks, there's a color factor of 3. There's a QCD perturbation series that begins with a somewhat large coefficient. Oh, God. 17 over 3 pi alpha s. And this is alpha s renormalized at the Higgs mass scale. When you multiply all that out, it's 3 times 1.24. So there's a somewhat large QCD correction. But there's an even larger QCD correction from the following source. That factor of mf over mh should really be a factor of mf of mh over mh squared. So in order to remove large logarithms from this expression, we should renormalize the Higgs mass, the fermion mass, at the scale of the Higgs mass, which is the momentum transfer that goes into that vertex. And that actually has a few surprises. So how many of you know about the scale dependence of masses in QCD? Raise your hand, please. Okay, so some fraction of the audience. But this is actually something that you need to know about. If I have a quark mass, like alpha s, this is a running parameter in QCD. So as a function of the log of q, it evolves. What you probably will suspect is that it gets stronger at small distances. That is, as you account more and more QCD effects, the apparent mass gets larger. And then you should probably stop this computation when the value of q becomes the mass itself. So this is on a log scale. The typical convention that's made is that the mass here would be the ms bar mass, and it is typically evaluated at mf ms bar at mf. And these are the numbers for quark masses that you see quoted, for example, in the particle data tables. And so the relation between that quantity, let me just modify this formula, ms bar of mf. So this is what you see quoted in the particle data tables. This is what you need to evaluate that quantity. And the ratio is an order one factor. Alpha S of MH divided by alpha S of MF, whatever that is, to the 4 over B0, where B0 is, 23/3, the value of the first QCD beta function coefficient, plus alpha S corrections. So this rearranges the masses a little. So if I quote these masses for U, D, S, C, and B, you find values that are smaller and also in a slightly different registration with respect to the leptons than what you expect. The values are about 1.5, 3, this is MeV, 60, 700, and 2800. So you usually see the bottom quark mass quoted as 4.1 GeV or something like that. But to evaluate the Higgs width, you really need to use a value closer to this one. When you put all that together, you see the Chomp quark mass has gotten a lot smaller than the value that you have in the particle data tables. And it's sufficiently much smaller that the square of that times the factor of 3 doesn't overcome the larger coupling that comes from the tau. And so if, let's just write this over here. If I scale to what's going to be the eventual value, the branching ratio of Higgs to BB bar, when you add everything up, this turns out to be the dominant mode, and the number is about 58% for the known value of the Higgs mass, then this would be tau at 6.3%, charm at 3%, strange at, oh my God, yeah, 0.03%. And mu at 0.02%. And always a pretty straightforward decay, at least from a theoretical point of view, either L plus L minus or a two-jet system with a total mass of 125 GeV. Yes?
What do you do with the other thing, MF and the cable, the one inside the three halves factor? Is that also the running mass, or is that?
That should also be the running mass. Now, fortunately, it's totally unimportant. But in B physics, you actually have to worry about that factor when you have B to C decays. And Itai maybe can correct me, but I thought the right prescription is to take the charm mass for the purpose of the total width computation at the MS bar of MB value to get everything right. For Higgs, it's totally irrelevant because for anything the Higgs is going to decay to, that's very small. Okay, good. So now we've actually finished everything in this column, and we're well on our way to a complete understanding of the Higgs decays. Now, let's go back here. Let me. If I start in the heat of passion erasing that blackboard, please yell at me. Okay. The next thing that I'd like to discuss are the Higgs to on-shell and off-shell gauge boson decay widths. So the coupling is G mu nu. So naively, the coupling would be a Higgs boson to two photons. So this would be mv squared over v times epsilon of, let's put here W plus W minus, epsilon of W plus dot epsilon of W minus. And I think you can see immediately that this is a structure that we discussed this morning in relation to the Goldstone-Boson equivalence theorem. So if indeed the Higgs mass were much greater than the W and Z thresholds, then you would not only get the W masses here instead of the B masses, so you get a very large prefactor, but you'd also get an enhancement of S over 2 MW squared from the product of the two epsilons. And so the prediction for a heavy Higgs boson, that is counterfactually heavy Higgs boson, is that the Higgs would decay dominantly to W and Z. It even beats the top quark, because even though the top quark is heavier, the W and Z have this factor. And the explanation of this factor is, anyone? Of course, because the heavy Higgs, in order to be heavy, it has to be strongly coupled to itself. And in the regime where the Higgs is well above the WW threshold, the Higgs coupling to itself is much larger than the Higgs coupling to SU2 cross U1. So that it's exactly this enhancement. This enhancement is just lambda over G squared. Now, this even applies for the Higgs at the real value of 125. It's still true that this factor is a substantial one, and actually longitudinal polarizations will dominate these decays. Now, that's actually quite an interesting, well, let me say one more thing, and then we'll come back to this. So there's Higgs to WW and Higgs to ZZ. And the way we'll see it is one of these particles at least has to be off the mass shell. So we allow the W's and Z's to decay either to QQ bar or L plus L minus. And then we'll look at events with four fermion final states with the four fermion summing to the mass of the Higgs. You can actually compute the partial width. I won't do it for you, but it's a nice exercise. When one Z is on mass shell and the other Z is off mass shell, it's a quite straightforward computation to actually get an analytic expression for the partial width. Unfortunately, that's only good to about 15%, because what happens is that both Z's kind of cheat off the mass shell to maximize the phase space integral. Some time ago, before the mass of the Higgs was known, I made this plot. No need to turn on the lights. But you see that this is the W and this is the Z, and both of them, no need to turn off the lights. Both of them cheat a little downward, and you see here a mass distribution. So if you hadn't been cheating, these would be at some precise values. So for accuracy, you need to do the complete phase space integral over four bodies. Now, something that's more interesting about these decays is that in the case where you have Higgs to ZZ to four leptons, you can actually find this signal above background at LHC in a relatively straightforward way. The rate is small. This thing here has a branching ratio of, if I remember correctly, 2.3%. And the decay rate to here, if you have L and L prime equal to electrons and muons, is 6.7% squared. So in the end, this turns out to be a 2.7%. In the end, this turns out to be about a 10 to the minus 4 branching ratio. So it's highly suppressed, but it's also highly characteristic in the LHC environment to have four leptons and basically no hadronic activity in the event. I'll show you the plot a little later. But what I'd like to realize is that once you have a configuration like this, you can actually do some very interesting physics with it. Because let's imagine that we go to the Higgs rest frame, the two Z's come back to back, and then each one decays to leptons, and there are the following variables which are very important. First of all, I've emphasized to you that in the frame of each Z, the orientation of the lepton gives you the polarization analysis of the Z. So if the angle is small, that means, as we've learned, a transversely polarized Z boson. If the angle here is large, that's a longitudinally polarized Z boson. And the prediction from this consideration is that the longitudinal polarizations dominate. Also, we can measure the relative phi angle between these two decay planes. And as you might imagine, the planes being parallel favor the hypothesis of a scalar Higgs. The planes being orthogonal favor a hypothesis of a pseudoscalar Higgs. So, for example, that would be something that couples not the way I wrote on the board I've erased, but with a coupling like that, that would be characteristic of a pseudoscalar boson, that predicts that the two decay planes are orthogonal. So at the LHC, there are of order 20 of these events per experiment accumulated so far. But nevertheless, they're very beautiful events, and one can try to use all the variables that I've just described and even more to do the Higgs polarization analysis. And okay, now you need to turn out the lights because this is really hard to see. So this is the current status. And please look at this very carefully because, well, what can I say? It's not completely persuasive. But nevertheless, if you know what you're looking for, as a theorist, you can be happy. So here's the data. This is the prediction for the decay angle of the Z. And as you see, that's supposed to peak up in the center. So that would be longitudinal polarization. Whereas if it couples, the Higgs couples to this hypothesis, or maybe even also to F mu nu squared. So this is something called the dilaton hypothesis. You prefer something that peaks up at the ends. And you see that there's some slight preference at the 1 or 1.5 sigma level that it actually does peak up in the middle. Similarly, if you look at the angle between the two decay planes, you expect a peak at 0 and 2 pi when you have a scalar production. And you expect a peak at 90 degrees when you have pseudoscalar production. And if you just squint your eyes, you see the data again at the 1.5 sigma level or something like that does favor the hypothesis of scalar over pseudoscalar. OK, if you do a multivariate analysis, you can improve the level of significance of these discriminations. So here's some results published by CMS, where they compare the standard model hypothesis. Let me just finish the sentence. Where they compare the standard model hypothesis, which would have a likelihood distribution, which is given by the yellow, against an alternative hypothesis, which has the likelihood distribution of blue in terms of the variables used in the fit. And so this one is basically the discrimination of scalar and pseudoscalar. This one is the discrimination, which you see there actually is some, between the hypothesis where the Higgs decay couples to W plus W minus, or rather ZZ, and where the Higgs couples to purely transverse. And the others are various models where the 125 GeV particle is a spin 2 with various sets of couplings. So I don't know whether you should be totally persuaded on the basis of what I've told you just now or not. In the next few years, we're going to very much enlarge the data set for Higgs bosons. And all of the plots I showed will become much refined. And it'll eventually be in the textbooks that all of these distributions, I hope, are working out just the way they're supposed to in the standard model. So now I'll ask.
On the previous slide, on the y-axis, the yes. Events was scaled by some factor.
Yes. Which one?
The next one.
This one?
The
the amount of events divided by like
0.5? Oh, it's events per bin.
Oh, okay.
It's just events per bin. Okay. As I said, there are, you know, 15 or 20 events over the whole plot. And I'm sorry, it's because this number is small. That's all we've got. Okay. Good. Okay. Lights back on, I guess. Okay. So that's what I wanted to tell you about the these two decay modes. And maybe I should write in the numbers. But maybe I should look up the numbers before I write them in so I can actually get them right. Yeah, so the standard model predictions here are 22% and 2.7%. Again, the standard model prediction here is 58%. So this is supposed to be the dominant decay mode, and this is probably the next dominant. And then you come down to the percent level and below with the other possible modes. Okay, now finally, we should discuss these modes, glu-glu, gamma-gamma, and gamma-z. Glu-glu is the simplest, and so I'll give an extended discussion of that, and then I'll try and generalize that to the other cases. So how can Higgs decay to glu-glu? The first 2 seconds that you think about this, you might say that it's totally impossible because the Higgs only couples to massive things and the gluon is a massless particle. So it's obviously impossible that the Higgs could couple to two massless gluons. And that's true at the tree level, but at the loop level, there's a way out, which is that the Higgs can couple to some kind of fermion, which gets a mass, so here you have an MF. And then that thing, if it's colored, for example, can couple to two gluons. And when we compute these diagrams, we're going to get a non-zero result. And so that is then a way to have the Higgs be able to decay through a loop diagram to two gluons. A similar argument will work for two photons. Now, there's a very interesting and counterintuitive property of these diagrams. The diagrams are, first of all, proportional to a factor of MF. But then you can figure out in one of two ways, either by doing dimensional analysis on the vertex or by effective operators, that the diagram itself has a 1 over mass in it. I think with effective operators, it's easier. The structure has to be the Higgs, and then if the theory is gauge invariant, then the diagram has to couple to F mu nu squared for QCD. And this is a dimension 5 operator. So in the coefficient has to have dimensions of 1 over mass. And so these diagrams have to be proportional to MF over M, where M is some appropriate mass that arises from computing the Feynman diagram. OK, now what is M? Well, there are two cases. The first case is the case in which MF is much less than M Higgs. And the other is the case where MF is much greater than M Higgs. When MF is much less than M Higgs, the momentum that circulates in the loop will be of order the Higgs mass. And so we'll get a contribution MF over M Higgs times some number. MF over M Higgs, the highest mass fermion that satisfies this is the bottom quark mass. And this is, as we've said, a couple percent. So this is going to be a percent level correction to whatever answer we get over here. Actually, I think when you have interference of this with the other contribution I'll talk about, it becomes a 5 or 10% correction. But in any case, it's small for any fermion with a mass much less than the Higgs. However, when MF is much greater than M Higgs, the fermions in the loop are off shell by an amount MF. And so what you get is MF over MF, which is order one. So it's very odd. The loop diagram that sends the Higgs into two gluons is negligible when the Higgs can decay to those fermions. But it's important when the Higgs can't decay to the fermions because the fermions are too heavy. And what that means is that in the standard model, the only contribution which is really important is the top quark contribution. Actually, this number here is independent of mass. So if there were a fourth generation of quarks and leptons, which got its entire mass from the Higgs boson, then you would get three times the contribution in the amplitude that I'm about to calculate for you, then you would get nine times the contribution in the rate, and it would be totally incompatible with the experimental measurements. So this is probably now the strongest piece of experimental evidence against the existence of a fourth generation. Okay, well now let's compute these diagrams. So what can I say? One way to do it is to get a very large piece of paper. And I do recommend that to you because they're when you do the computation, there are some interesting things that happen that have to do with dimensional regularization. You have to dimensionally regularize because the gauge invariance, as we've seen here, is extremely important, and you have to protect that. So those of you who are interested in such things, please do the direct computation of this Feynman diagram. And you'll see it'll, well, at least if you're a theorist, it's fun. However, I'm going to take a little shortcut because something that I already know, well, maybe you don't know it, but you should know it, is that there's a non-zero value which is, quote, well known for the vacuum polarization amplitude in QED, which is due to a top quark. And the value of this diagram, you can also get it from the analogous result in quantum electrodynamics, is 1 half, so if the momentum k is going in here, 1 half k squared g mu nu minus k mu k nu times the trace of ta tb times alpha s over 3 pi. And then it's a logarithmically divergent diagram, so there's a log of lambda squared over mt squared. So I'm going to try to use this result in order to compute the value of these diagrams. Now, I guess it's useful to try and figure out what we're shooting for when we do this. So let me use this interaction up here to try and guess what the form of this vertex will be. And the form of the vertex I claim should be the following. It should be, when I compute the loop, Higgs A mu B nu. So there should be a delta AB, which actually we already see here. This is 1 half delta AB. The momentum structure should be K1 dot K2 G mu nu minus K1 nu K2 mu. And that's just gauge invariance. If you dot K into either vertex, you have to get zero. And this is the unique structure that does it. Or you can just get the Feynman rules for that, and this is what you would find. And let's call the coefficient of this A. So now what I'm going to try and do is determine A in a sneaky way. And the sneaky way that I'm going to use is to remember that the mass scale of even the top quark mass is set by the Higgs vacuum expectation value. So we can get those diagrams by taking d by dv of the value of this diagram. And when I do that, what I find is I k squared g mu nu minus k mu k nu. Oh, by the way, this gives these diagrams for the Higgs momentum equal to zero. So that'll be a good approximation if the Higgs mass is much lighter than the top quark mass. Otherwise, the formula will be a little more complicated. So once again, differentiating this equation with respect to V, we find this. We find a half delta AB. We find alpha S over 3 pi. And differentiating the logarithm gives minus 2 times 1 over V. And there we are. So we can immediately identify A is equal to alpha S over, the 2's cancel, alpha S over 3 pi V. And we can now trade, if you like, V for MW. So we could also write this as G times alpha S divided by 6 pi MW. And please notice that this structure here, at least up to a minus sign, matches up exactly with this structure here in the limit where the Higgs momentum is zero. Okay, well, now we're all set. Now you just plug that Feynman rule, you integrate over phase space, and you find an explicit expression for the Higgs partial width to two gluons. Which is alpha W, because it's G squared, alpha S squared, divided by, if I did this right, 72 pi cubed. No. Times MH cubed over MW squared. And when you work it out, it's of order 6%. There's also a QCD correction that enhances it somewhat. Now, if you were to actually compute the diagram, there'd be some non-trivial dependence on the ratio of the Higgs mass and the top quark mass. And if you're very good at such things, you can work it out. Where tau is equal to mh squared over mt squared. The other way around, 4mt squared over mh squared. And one thing which is not hard to do is expand this formula for large tau and see that it goes to 1. Okay. Now, this calculation gives us the idea that we can also compute the branching ratio for Higgs to gamma gamma. So Higgs to gamma gamma occurs by, I'll just draw one diagram now, a similar diagram where I just use the electromagnetic coupling instead of the color gauge field coupling. And then over here, I should also include another contribution from W bosons. And actually, it turns out that this one is dominant, and these two diagrams have destructive interference, as we'll see in just a moment. The full computation, again, is interesting. It's a little complicated, but for those of you who are interested in perturbation theory and gauge theories, it's useful. It's easiest to do it in the Feynman-Tofte gauge. And you have to remember that there's also a Goldstone boson in the loop in that gauge that you have to include. So once again, we can try and intuit the answer by looking at vacuum polarization diagrams. So the gamma-gamma vacuum polarization diagram for the top quark, again, has the structure times 3, the color factor, the top quark charge squared. There's a factor of alpha over 3 pi, and there's a log of lambda over m top squared. So we can treat that contribution exactly the same way as we treated the one up there. To treat the W contribution, we need the W contribution to the electromagnetic vacuum polarization. And that, of course, is going to be proportional to the beta function of SU2. So the final answer that we get for the A in this case is going to be, let's see, over here I had a, alpha over, let me write 4 pi now. There's a 4/3, there's a color factor of 3 and 2/3 for the top quark charge. And what stands in front of that is minus 22/3, which is the beta function of SU2. And then we also have to remember that we shouldn't forget the Goldstone bosons. So you have to add back a third. And so that is the A factor for Higgs to gamma gamma when you put everything together. And then again, you square this and you get an appropriate expression here, which I think I'm not going to write down. In any event, when you add all the leading radiative corrections, you find that the branching ratio for Higgs to glu-glu actually makes a surprisingly large contribution. It's 8.6% branching ratio. And the branching ratio for Higgs to gamma-gamma is down by alpha squared over alpha s squared, so it's actually really small, 0.23%. is the standard model prediction. Okay, well now we're doing excellently. So let's just recall a few of these numbers. So this is 9%, this is 0.2%, this is going to turn out to be about 0.1%. This one over here is, 6%, 3%, 10 to the minus 4. So this is getting interesting. You know, if we're going to collect eventually over the LHC lifetime 100 million Higgses per experiment, it's really possible to probe this whole set of branching ratios, maybe even with quite high accuracy. And so now let's talk a little about what this has to do with experimental reality such as we know it now. So first of all, let me show you this plot. This plot is obsolete because, you have to duck. Okay. This plot is obsolete because it was made before we knew what the value of the Higgs mass was. Now we know, and it's the Higgs branching ratios as a function of the mass. Nevertheless, if you're interested in Higgs physics, it's probably interesting to take all the calculations that I've done here and write a code that generates this plot. And it's kind of fun. You see, when the Higgs goes above the W threshold, that immediately shoots up and becomes like a 90% branching ratio. And when the Higgs goes above the Z threshold also, those two dominate, and everything else goes well below the percent level of branching ratio. However, very fortunately, we happen to live here, so there's a very wide spectrum of branching ratios which are potentially available. Okay. Now we have to talk a little about how to produce the Higgs at the LHC. And, sorry? Oh, sorry.
What's what's the reason for the dip in the Z set?
Because the W, that's a very interesting feature. It's because the W is on shell, but the Z still has a Z off shell. So the ZZ is suppressed by a factor of alpha because you have to actually decay the Z. So you have to go to one higher order. So it's at the, as you see, the few percent level with respect to WW. So that's quite a remarkable feature. And of course, it would be, we'd really understand that if the mass of the Higgs turned out to be here, but it isn't. So what can I say? Now it's just a curiosity. Any other questions? Okay. So the next thing we have to discuss, and maybe I'll do this in the dark because you need to see this plot, are what are the production mechanisms for Higgs at LHC? So here I'm just going to draw some Feynman diagrams and discuss this very briefly, although there's a whole story connected with this as well. The dominant mechanism for Higgs production at a hadron collider. Now, how do you produce the Higgs at a hadron collider? Well, obviously, it's very difficult because the Higgs couples only to things with mass. And at a hadron collider, you're colliding protons. But the protons don't get their mass from the Higgs. They get their mass from some strong interaction QCD effect. So the proton, from this point of view, is just a bag of quarks and gluons, all of which are essentially massless. The best chance that you have is to collide through two gluons through the vertex that I was computing up there. So this is the glue to Higgs cross-section. It's the top line on this plot. And you see at 14 TeV, it's pretty effective. It's 50 picobarns. So if you remember the slides I showed you yesterday, a picobarn is quite far below the total cross-section. But at least it's comparable to top quark production. So in principle, we should be able to see these things. Unfortunately, the Higgs produced in this way is more or less totally uncharacteristic. It can decay to BB bar, but as I told you, it's in that way a million times below the BB bar background at comparable mass. CC bar, there's some ideas about how to do that at LHC, but that's still extremely challenging. Some of these other modes, though, are more characteristic. ZZ, especially when this decays to 4 leptons, is a very characteristic mode. Gamma-gamma, of course, you can do a complete reconstruction of the Higgs by putting together 2 gammas. WW, I'll have to tell you what the status is. And most of these other, and mu plus mu minus, someday will compute the mass. We'll have the mass of mu plus mu minus pairs. We'll have the signal from Drell-Yan. And of course, there's a Z peak on that. And here, at the level of 10 to the minus 4 of that peak, we'll have the Higgs peak. And it is thought that by the time the LHC accumulates its full sample, this little blip here will actually have emerged from the noise. Yes?
By the way, maybe you can comment on that. But I think the fact that the cross-section for Higgs production is roughly the same as a PT bar is actually not a coincidence, right? Because you essentially get you open up the loop.
Right.
And so you gain you gain the loop factor, but you lose in the two body.
Right. So Higgs to TT bar is this from glue. Higgs production is this, and they're of the same order of magnitude in terms of the rate. For the reasons Itai just explained to you.
But why don't you lose on the loop though?
Sorry? But here, this is a resonance, and here there's two body phase space.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Good. The next thing we could try is the process that I talked about this morning at the very end of the lecture, WW fusion. And in fact, whether it's WW or ZZ, there is a diagram like this with two forward jets and Higgs production. And that corresponds to this purple line here, which is again more than a pico barn. Then you could have so-called Higstrolung, which is, for example, you produce a W or a Z, and then use the W or Z Higgs coupling. To radiate a Higgs recoiling against the W or a Z. Then you let this guy decay to some leptonic final state, this one L plus L minus or invisible. Actually, when it's fully tagged like this, you could actually use this as a tag for Higgs decays. The background you would be talking about is QQ bar annihilation into Z, which has a somewhat different kinematic distribution. So this is actually the mode which is used at the LHC to bound invisible Higgs decays. Someday, we'll study this process in E plus E minus annihilation. And then a Z like that at a given energy, well, the Z will be at a fixed energy in the lab of, I believe, 113 GeV. And whatever's on the other side is the Higgs. And in that environment, you can discover Higgs to invisible decays even below the percent level of branching ratio. So that's something very interesting to look forward to. And then finally, the last process listed there is TT bar production with Higgs radiation from the top. And this isn't itself a major mode of Higgs production, as you see, but it's one that can be used to potentially measure the Higgs TT bar coupling, which is a very interesting object in itself that doesn't really come directly into any of the branching ratios that I discussed here. Okay, so what's the status of these various processes? Well, first of all, the discovery of the Higgs was based on these two modes, gamma-gamma and ZZ, where the Z decays to four leptons. This is really an interesting illustration of the difficulty of doing LHC physics. If we want to look for the Higgs in the dominant mode, the dominant total cross-section mode, somehow none of these processes are really available. And the only ones that are available to actually see a Higgs peak are the ones where we see the full final state in objects that are not QCD objects. So those are just these two modes. And this one is a 0.2%. And this one is actually, as I said, a 10 to the minus 4 branching ratio. Nevertheless, here they are. So this, you've probably all seen this plot before. This is the CMS two-photon mass distribution weighted so that the categories with high signal to background show up with increased weight on this plot. It's got, as you see, a noticeable resonance at 125 GeV. And when you subtract the background, there's something like that. This is now of order 12 sigma observation of this state. And there will be a similar plot, which I'm not going to show you from that. In the Higgs to four leptons, here's the plot from ATLAS. There's a similar plot, which I won't show you from CMS. There are, something like 15 or 20 events in this peak, and of those, only a couple background. So it's really a truly remarkable feature. Ordinarily, you can't show an LHC event display and say, this is something, because almost every LHC event display that you show is dominated by standard model background. However, in this case, it is very likely that this event is a Higgs decaying to four leptons. You can see the electrons observed in the electromagnetic calorimeter, the muons, which penetrate the detector, and the total invariant mass of the four states is 124 GeV. So it's in that peak that I showed you. So in both of those modes, there's really kind of overpowering evidence that this particle exists and at the same mass in both modes and both experiments of about 125 GeV. Okay, well now, to what extent can we find the other modes that we had talked about? Probably the next one to discuss is W plus W minus. So W plus W minus is a little more of a problem. It's a very dominant decay mode of the Higgs boson. But the way you would observe it is in L plus nu L minus nu bar. So it's two leptons and also missing energy. So you could constrain the kinematics if you knew that this came from the Higgs. But unfortunately, there are other processes that also produce W plus W minus, just QQ bar to W plus W minus, just like E plus E minus to W plus W minus that we discussed this morning. So there's some kinematic differences between these processes, so you can make the best selection that you can of the events. But here's more or less the final plot shown by Atlas. So let me try and remember what's shown here. This is mu and E. And up there, there's zero jets. Again, I think a jet here is a PT greater than 20 GeV, R equals 0.4 anti-KT jet. So you pick out events with two muons, with mu plus mu minus, missing energy, and zero jets of the description that I just gave. And what you see is that the number of events is almost completely accounted for by QQ bar to WW, which is this purple area of this plot. But there is a significant excess, which is well modeled by the red region, which is the standard model prediction for the Higgs. And so people consider this as, well, actually, it is more than 5 sigma evidence for the presence of this decay mode. And by measuring the excess, you can then make a measurement of the Higgs to WW branching ratio or coupling. Now, we need to go to the fermionic modes. And the most accessible of those is tau. Now, you might ask, how is this possible? Because a tau decay always results in a neutrino. It's tau to neutrino pi, neutrino rho, or something like that, or neutrino, neutrino bar, electron, or muon. But you can use the following very simple trick. If you have a proton collider, and it produces tau plus tau minus, and the production is such that the Higgs is at close to zero transverse momentum. Actually, in fact, if the production is such that the Higgs is close to zero transverse momentum, when the tau decays, it'll be so highly boosted that that single track will follow the tau direction. And then there'll also be neutrinos, one or more, that also follow that direction. Nevertheless, if I say that the tau momentum lines up with the single prong here, there are two unknowns, namely the energy of the neutrinos here and the energy of the neutrinos here. But there are two constraints, which are transverse momentum bounds in the two directions. And so you can solve for those two energies. And the mass resolution is about 20 GeV. And so in that way, you can try and reconstruct, for example, glue to Higgs to tau plus tau minus. And actually, I guess I didn't have to assume that the tau was at rest. So you can so if you see the tagging jets, you can see QQ Higgs going to tau plus tau minus. And I think hopefully on the next slide, there's an event display. Oh, yeah, here it is. So I can't guarantee to you that this is a Higgs event, unlike the previous case. In fact, most likely, it's a W fusion to a Z, which then decays to tau plus tau minus. But in any event, this is what such an event is supposed to look like. Two very forward jets, which then require that you have good forward calorimetry, as we were discussing yesterday. Here's a muon. Here's an electron. And then you would try and see whether those guys make the tau mass or the Z mass by doing this kind of reconstruction. Now, unfortunately, when you get your actual event samples, they look something like this. So here's the CMS publication on the search for Higgs to tau plus tau minus. Actually, VBF is the code for this vector boson fusion reaction. So the signal is most significant when you have these tagging jets. And the tight VBF tag is basically the search for tagging jets accompanying the EMU or E single hadron system. The yellow, as I already explained, is vector boson fusion to a Z boson, which then decays to tau plus tau minus. But fortunately, Zs also decay to L plus L minus. So you can experimentally measure the rate of this process and basically renormalize, so normalize whatever is your model for that background. And then the claim is that here we're seeing a small excess above background, or here. And so when you add up over all the categories, there is, in fact, a significant excess above background. I think the next, So as you see, again, this is a very hard game. This is Z production. This is actually continuum W plus W minus production, where you have two leptons and then some jets produced from the initial state of W plus W minus. And the game is to evaluate all of those backgrounds as carefully as you can and look for an excess that you can then ascribe to the Higgs boson. Now, finally, I'd like to just very briefly discuss Higgs to BB bar. So you can do that by a similar technique. For BB bar, the most powerful analyses, use these processes, where you have an identified vector boson recoiling against a Higgs. Unfortunately, again, you have to think about backgrounds very carefully. Because let's say you have an identified Z, which produces a Higgs. Something else that can happen is that when you produce a Z, you produce it in association with another Z that then decays to BB bar. So you have to include this as a background. Fortunately, the mass is different. But unfortunately, your mass resolution is not so good that you can really cleanly separate those peaks. And the other thing that can happen is you can have a gluon that, by a QCD splitting, splits to BB bar. And this gives a continuous mass spectrum, which overlaps the Higgs region. So now, here's the final plots shown by ATLAS and CMS. And as you see, there is roughly a 2-sigma signal, something like that, in each plot. So there is some, at least, preliminary evidence that this decay occurs. This is the ZZ, and the red is, in the model, the Z Higgs. And you can see that there is some preliminary evidence for that. If you open the paper and turn back one page, it looks like this. So these are particular categories which are added together. This plot is also background subtracted, of course. So here you see what the backgrounds are. In various categories, these are ZZ production. I think the dominant background here, this is TT bar. And this is Z plus a Z decaying to BB bar. So once again, a very difficult game. But one has actually a large enough event sample and sufficiently good modeling that you can make some hay with it and try and determine these partial widths. So let me just conclude by showing you this plot. This is the particle data group summary from the LHC run 1 of the various Higgs decay rates. So what's plotted here is the signal strength, which is to say, the cross-section for producing Higgs in the mode you're studying times the branching ratio divided by the standard model expectation. So 1 is agreement with the standard model. 0 is no evidence for the Higgs. And then the measurements are what they are. So you see a very strong evidence that there is indeed Higgs production in these modes, rather weaker evidence that there is Higgs production in BB with Higgs to BB bar. But remember, we're just starting out. I mean, this is the first LHC run to have observed this particle. the data sample will increase. First of all, the cross sections double basically when you go to 13 TeV. And then the data sample will also increase dramatically by a factor of, I think, about 10 between now and 2020. And then after that, another factor of 10. So we're going to learn a lot more about this particle and really be able to study its properties in great detail. I'm charged here only to talk about the standard model theory of Higgs, but there's a lot to say about the beyond the standard model theory of Higgs. And I think it really is interesting to try and pursue these measurements to the maximum accuracy that you can. The Higgs has to couple to everything. And if there's beyond the standard model particles, the Higgs will couple to them. And their effects will show up in these measurements at some level. And hopefully, we'll get there. So that'll be extremely interesting. Anyway, this completes my survey of the standard model in colliders. And I hope you folks have gotten at least a little inspiration from it. And so thank you very much.
Okay.
Yes?
In one of your slides, you mentioned you showed the mass of Higgs according to the Deagon channel. The question is that, what's the origin of the first resonance? And if it's uncertainty, why Atlas didn't report that on CMS report?
I'm sorry, this slide?
In 100 and, for example, 12 G.
Are you talking about this slide?
Yes, yeah.
Okay,
in
and?
In 112 GV, we have one resonance.
Oh. You mean here?
Yeah. CMS professors actually claim that's uncertainty. But
okay.
But in Atlas slides, we don't have this actually resonance.
Oh, yes. Okay.
What's the difference between CMS and Atlas, especially about this people?
Well, you know, you can produce a feature on any of these distributions just by statistical fluctuations. And then you have to argue very hard about whether the statistical fluctuation is probable or improbable. So right before the Higgs discovery, there was tremendous discussion within each experiment and within the community about what was really the criterion for a sufficiently high resonance. But I presume that this feature didn't meet that criterion. I don't know for sure. Natalia, do you know?
Not sure.
It looks like it's about 2 sigma,
yeah.
So that wouldn't do it. And then remember that that resonance can occur anywhere on the plot. So the probability that there is a 2 sigma deviation somewhere on this plot is probably 1. So then maybe you shouldn't be so convinced by it. And then, of course, if Atlas didn't see it, it's probably just a fluctuation. Yeah, you folks don't come from the era when people were discovering the hadronic resonances, but in the era when people did bubble chamber experiments back in the 1960s, resonances would come and go. They'd be a 3 sigma effect, and then the next year it would be nothing. But this one, I think, is here to stay.
The big one.
Yes.
Question, why is vector boson fusion called vector boson fusion and not weak boson or something? Because it's not all vector bosons that are contributing to it, right? The name is really misleading.
Of course, to make a neutral Higgs boson, it's got to be either WW, ZZ, or photon-photon.
Yeah.
And maybe you're quarreling that the photon is a proper vector boson that should be included. And it's got a minute rate because that goes through a loop diagram. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to apologize for the convention. I think I've now explained as much as I can.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? Please.
You mentioned that Higgs negative gluon.
Yes.
Exclude the fourth generation.
Yes.
Has this fourth generation already been excluded?
Well, you could argue that a fourth generation has to have So the fourth generation that I'm talking about is a generation that gets its whole mass from the Higgs boson. So it's one that would satisfy M capital T, for example, is the Y capital T over the square root of 2 times the Higgs vacuum expectation value. So you could say, well, if Y capital T is such that, let's say, YT squared over 4 pi is greater than 1, that's a strong interaction, and it might even cause the vacuum to break down or some catastrophe. So probably we should consider this to be some kind of upper limit on the strength of that couplet. So it's not a totally rigorous argument, but it's a reasonable, it's more than hand-waving, let's put it that way. So this limit puts a limit on that mass of about 600 GeV. If you have a T and a B, it's a somewhat lower limit. It's about 500 now. So the searches for fourth generation objects now go up to about 700 GeV. So by that criterion, again, if you believe the level of rigor in this argument, this was already excluded. However, the idea that a heavy fermion like this, or a pair of them, would cause an order of magnitude. All the numbers on this plot would be an order of magnitude larger if this generation existed, or at least the ones that come from W fusion, from gluon fusion. So this, and this. Those numbers would be an order of magnitude larger if there were a fourth generation. And that's certainly a much more convincing exclusion than the one I explained to you here. Other questions? Yes?
Can you maybe comment a little on how you can put bounds on the invisible decays of the Higgs through some of these processes?
Well, I'll tell you the simple way, and I think I don't know more than that. So maybe Natalia or Itai can help me here. But one very straightforward way to do it is to study the process where you have PP going to L plus L minus with the mass of the Z plus missing energy plus no jets. So that can certainly come from a process like this, where you have ZZ, where this guy goes to L plus L minus, and this guy goes to nu bar. However, the rate for that process is very well understood. So another possible origin of this signature would be the Higgs going to invisible and the Z over here going to L plus L minus. And so in the same way as in the last few slides I showed you, if you look for this signature and you model it and you find out that there's an excess over the prediction from this process, that would indicate that there's a Higgs decaying to invisible particles. So in that way, one obtains, I think today, now, I think I just saw a CMS preprint that gave a limit of about 20% on the branching ratio for Higgs to invisible by this technique. So so that's already quite impressive. I mean, in principle, the invisible could dominate the Higgs decays, but we now know it's less than 20%. Now, what would be even more impressive is if we could do this at an E plus E minus collider. Because here, we don't know what the center of mass energy is, right? Because these quarks are just coming out of the parton distribution. At an E plus E minus collider, you know what the center of mass energy is of the colliding electron and positron. And so if I study this decay, in fact, at an E plus E minus collider, you can study it either for L plus L minus over here, or for QQ bar. The only point is that it just has to have the mass of the Z. And actually, there's a lab energy of the Z, which, if I remember correctly, is 113 GeV when this guy is at 125. So if you see a Z boson at this energy, whatever's on the other side is the Higgs boson. And if you see nothing, that's an invisible decay. And that measurement can actually get you to branching ratios below 1%. So someday. Okay. Other questions? Yes.
How well can we measure the width, the decay width of the Higgs?
Oh, I should have said something about that, actually. The decay width of the Higgs is very small. I didn't go back and so I gave you some explicit computations of some partial widths. But it turns out that when you add everything up, the standard model prediction for the total width of the Higgs is 4 MeV. So this is way below the resolution for any resonance that you have at any collider, either PP or E plus E minus. There's some people argue you could get there with a mu plus mu minus collider. I'm very skeptical, and let me not go in that direction. So one way, however, that you can try and get this number out is by using an interference effect. So if I think about glue to Higgs, to some final state, like gamma-gamma. And then I think about now what do we have to do? We have to look at
I think it's often done with vector boson fusion with CC.
No, I don't want to talk about that first. I want to talk about the Lance Dixon and Fei Yi method. But unfortunately, I've forgotten what the reaction is. It's glue, where you have, as a higher order correction, another photon radiated. And then there's a reaction where you have two photons in the continuum and another photon. I'm not getting this right. So there's a reaction. Oh, I'm really embarrassed that I'm not. Do you remember, Natalia, what the reaction that Lance proposed? It's an interference of the Higgs production against the background. And there's actually quite a large effect in the tail of the Higgs.
Is it when not it, just this with the optional Higgs versus two photons?
I'm sorry. Please excuse me. It's the opposite of what I drew. It's glue, and then the box diagram to two photons. That's it. So this is a resonance. This is broadband. And what I showed you in the plot was this effect and then the resonance on top of it. But there's actually an interference between these two diagrams, which is surprisingly large in the tail. And by using that effect, Dixon and collaborators claimed that you could measure not this value, but that you could put a mass of about 16 MeV or something like that, eventually with the full LHC data set. Now, there's another very interesting reaction, which has actually been studied by CMS and Atlas, for which I could probably talk for a whole hour, but let me just put it out there. If you think about glue to ZZ production, there are interfering Feynman diagrams that look like this, where it's dominated by the top quark. You have glue, and let me draw some other diagram. Okay, so you have these three mechanisms for producing ZZ in PP collisions at high energy. Now, if you did a polarization analysis, you can try and suppress this as much as possible. And then these two diagrams both come dominantly from longitudinal Zs. Now, there is an effect that these diagrams have a cancellation. In fact, if you cut the diagrams like this, you see they have exactly the same cancellation, a kind of cancellation that we were discussing this morning in E plus E minus to W plus W minus. Each diagram is enhanced by this S over MZ squared factor. And then those enhancements cancel between the two diagrams. So CMS argued, well, if I take this diagram at its standard model value, and I just change the width of the Higgs here, actually, so if I take this at its standard model value and change the Higgs coupling to ZZ or the Higgs coupling here, I can destroy the cancellation. And then I get a lot of sensitivity to these couplings. And then I can compare that to, for example, the rate of total Higgs production. And here, the rate, the ratio of this diagram to that diagram depends on the width. And so by an argument like this, you can try and bound the width. And in the paper, the bound on the width is very strong. It's already about 16 MeV with the current data. The problem with that is that in order to change the Higgs width, you have to go beyond the standard model. And beyond the standard model will very often change this diagram. And in fact, it often has to, because Goldstone boson equivalence is still true, even if you're beyond the standard model. So there has to be some cancellation between these diagrams. And so it's a very interesting measurement to try and measure this diagram or this combination of diagrams. But it's a rather more theoretically knotty to interpret it. And I think I just want to stop here. OK?
All right, so that's, thank Michael again for